NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit, credit to the people.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Looking for a new show to dive into? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like the full season of FX's epic limited series Shogun, FX's new international spy thriller The Veil, starring Emmy and Golden Globe winner Elizabeth Moss. And don't miss the all-new crime series Under the Bridge, inspired by shocking true events and starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
Today's case features discussion of extreme acts of child sexual abuse, torture, and murder that some listeners might find offensive and extremely hard to stomach. For that reason, listener discretion is advised. December 13th, 1996. Sars-la-Bouzière, Belgium. Police officer René Michaux is investigating a house belonging to a convicted sex offender by the name of Marc Dutroux. With him is another man, a locksmith who has come to try and help the man search the house. During the search of the house, they find many disturbing items. Over 100 video cassettes are discovered, as well as whips, chains, handcuffs, and other instruments of restraint. Pornographic materials are found, as well as video cameras. Behind a set of shelves set into the wall, the officer and locksmith find a small doorway that leads down beneath the house into the ground. They go down, discovering a series of tunnels which fill the men with a sense of dread. They leave, taking the items they had discovered with them. A few days later, on December 19th, the men return to the house and investigate the catacombs beneath it further. The locksmith swears that he hears the cries of children, stating he will not leave the house until the children whose voices he has heard are discovered. Officer Michaux replies, "Who is the police officer here? You or me?" The two men leave, while in the darkness, 8-year-old Julie Lejeune and Melissa Russo are left to slowly starve to death. Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Todd, and I would like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take a look at the crimes of Mark Dutroux, man who is considered possibly Belgium's worst serial killer. As I'm sure you noticed before I began describing part of one of the crimes in the trailer, there was a bit of a warning, and that is with good reason. This case is unlike any I have covered before. Even the story of Hissing Sid and his Dirty Dozen from England pales in comparison to the crimes of this individual. So if you are someone who has a difficult time hearing about this type of torture and abuse, I really suggest that you tap out now. While I'm not going to sit here and go into the specific details of what this scumbag did to each individual victim, even just brushing against the things that he did in generalities is very, very dark. Now that that's out of the way, before we dive into it, a couple of show notes and plugs. I still am waiting to do a couple of interviews for upcoming episodes that I really think you guys are going to enjoy, one of which I know for myself I am going to enjoy, but I'm not going to get into that one until it happens. If you would like to follow me on social media, that would be Facebook, Instagram, MeWe. Just search for Ian Totten, author. If you want to join the Deathcast group that is on Facebook, once you have found my author page, look into the community. There is a Deathcast group there. A lot of people have been joining lately. We have fun in there. We post a lot of off-color, dark memes. If you would like to follow me on Twitter, just search for Corpse Creek. If you'd like to find any of my 5 novels, just go to Google and put in Ian Totten. Click search and my books will come up. I am available on pretty much every website that sells books, including Barnes & Noble, Thrift Books, and Amazon. And most of my books are available in Kindle and paperback format, with one, The House of Silver Doors, available on Audible, and another one, my last novel that came out, The Throwaway Girls of Olympia, will soon be joining that. I just got back the unmastered recordings of it a few weeks ago, so I'm just waiting on the producer to get finished, and that will be coming out. If you'd like to join my mailing list, just go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com. That's my official website. There you can find various authors who I enjoy and support, as well as listen to the show. And if you are so inclined, make a donation to the show. Now buy me a cup of coffee or a pack of cigarettes. No amount is too small and no amount is too large. If you want to help support the show, find it on your favorite podcast app, like, subscribe, share it on social media, and leave a 5-star review. They really do help the show and help other people to find it. Alright, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself someplace comfortable to sit, relax, kick your feet up, close your eyes, get yourself something to drink. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes.
Let's go into the crypt.
So we're going to be looking at the life and crimes of Marc Dutroux. And there really is nothing redeemable about this individual in any way, shape, or form. If you look into him, you can see that, as with a lot of serial killers, every aspect of his life was constructed in order for him to commit his crimes. But he was really above and beyond a lot of other serial killers in that he didn't just take his victims, rape them, and kill them. Dutroux was so far beyond anything that I've really encountered, and I've read and seen a lot. He was the type of individual who would keep his victims alive for months on end. And if you're even vaguely aware of the Pizzagate conspiracy theory, whether you believe it or not, it's inconsequential. This guy here was what Pizzagate reported to me. He was making horrific videos. He was selling children. He was part of a network that operated all throughout Europe and possibly into the United States. And there's a lot of evidence out there that shows he was protected by some fairly higher up individuals. I'm talking lawyers, magistrates, senators, other people in government, police officers. And as we go along through this, you're really gonna see just how corrupt the Belgian government police forces were. It's sickening, and there's so much that is mind-blowing concerning this guy. Marc-Paul Alain Dutroux was born November 6, 1956 in Ixel, Belgium, which from what I gather is in the Brussels area of Belgium. Because of that, it's near a major city. It has a pretty high population. He was the oldest of five children born to Victor and Janine, who were both teachers, and he spent his formative years living in the Belgian Congo, which is something you see fairly often when you look at really international criminals like Dutroux. His parents spent a lot of time in the African continent, and there's really no telling what may or may not have happened during that period of his life that led him to what he became. It is known, though, that according to Mark, he was repeatedly abused by both of his parents. Now, this abuse was in the way of beatings. There may be some veracity to the statement, or it might just be a way that he has found in his own mind to pass the buck, as it were, for his own crimes. At some point during the 1960s, the family returned to Belgium after what was known as the Congo Crisis, which was a period of political upheaval and conflict that took place in the Congo prior to and during its first years of independence. Just a very quick history lesson. During the period preceding this conflict, most of the areas on the African continent were colonies to other countries, mostly white European countries. Most famously, the apartheid system in South Africa. So it's
pretty reasonable to assume that Mark and his family were not wanted where they were living in the Congo and may have faced, you know, some pretty harsh reactions from the locals. After returning to Belgium, it seems that the family lived a fairly middle-class existence up until 1971, when his parents divorced. Dutroux stayed with his mother before moving out on his own at the age of 16, at which point he began working as a male prostitute, moving from house to house and town to town. In 1976, he was either 19 or 20, he married his first wife, whose name has been given as both Michelle and Francois. Mark has gone on the record to state that he routinely beat his wife as well as cheated on her, most notably with a woman by the name of Michelle Martin. Now, his first wife bore two children to the couple, and it's unknown as to whether or not he had abused these children. But at any rate, he divorced his first wife in 1983. Various sources state that he worked briefly as an electrician, but for the most part, it seems that Mark spent his time unemployed, eventually getting some form of public assistance because he was found to be disabled. It is known that he was involved in burglaries, drug dealing, and car thefts. And that's an important bit of information to remember, because eventually, Mark is going to end up owning at least 6 properties and a total of 10 houses, which the police would claim came from his car theft and drug dealing, although the evidence points to much darker forms of crime and financial support. At some point in the mid-1980s, Mark and Michelle began to abduct and rape young girls. There isn't a lot of information about this spate of crimes, and part of that has to do with the fact that Europe is much different than the United States. And oftentimes, particularly with older crimes, they will not release the ages of the individuals who were victims, only stating the number and sex of the victims. In February of 1986, the couple was arrested and charged with the kidnapping and rape of 5 girls. In 1989, the couple married while imprisoned, and Mark was eventually sentenced to 13 and a half years, while his wife Michelle was given 4 years. However, Mark was let out after only 3 years, and once his wife was out, they began to build their plans for what it is that they wanted to do, and according to various sources, it was actually Michelle Martin, Mark's wife, who came up with the idea of digging underground cells and tunnels beneath the various homes that they owned in order to store the children that they planned to kidnap. Some sources say that Mark later told police the idea was
to interconnect all of these houses via underground tunnels, so you could be in one house and go beneath it and travel to another one where a victim might be held and abuse them and then leave without anyone being any the wiser that you had been there or that such horrific assaults had taken place. He also stated in later interviews that he had actually built the underground network as a area to hide children from a pedophile ring that he had been hired by to procure young girls for. The idea of a large ring like this obviously is fairly controversial and seen as being a conspiracy, but time and again you see these things that might make, you know, a little bit of headline before being very quickly covered up. Particularly in Europe, there have been a number of cases involving these types of groups. We have had them in the United States, most notably the Fox Island case out of Michigan, I believe it was, in the mid-1970s, where a multimillionaire, Francis D. Sheldon, was found to have constructed a nationwide network of pedophiles who would transfer boys all across the country for the use and abuse of other members of this network. And he was pretty brazen about it. He actually put out magazines and pamphlets that were disseminated to individuals who might be interested in partaking of this. Again, this isn't conspiracy theory, this is actual fact. And it seems that Mark Dutroux was of a similar ilk. Mark was a very organized, well-financed individual. And his wasn't a case where people didn't know what was going on. In fact, over the course of 1995, 1996, when he really got going, police received a lot of tips pointing them to what it was that he was doing. However, it seems as though they really just ignored the information being given to them. The best that I could find is that from the time of his release until he began acting out his desires, Mark spent much of his time working on these underground lairs and labyrinths beneath the homes that he owned. However, there's a good amount of information out there that the areas he was known to frequent and to live in saw a dramatic increase in the number of missing young girls, particularly between ages of 5 and 16. However, it was a situation where the police weren't able to find most of these girls, so they really just let it go, which to me is absolutely disgusting. On June 24th, 1995, two 8-year-olds, Julie Lejeune and Melissa Russo, were kidnapped after going for a walk in Grace Malone, which is a city in Belgium. And they were taken to Mark's home in Marcinelle, where he kept them imprisoned in the dungeon that he had built. Mark's wife would videotape the torture and sexual assaults that Mark perpetrated on these two girls on numerous occasions. There is some evidence that Mark sold some of these videotapes and that he also moved them around to different houses that he owned in order to throw off the scent of anyone
who may be looking for him. There's a lot of evidence that Mark was using psychiatric drugs that he had been prescribed upon his release from prison to keep the girls drugged and in a stupor throughout their ordeal of being held captive by him. Mark would allow the girls to write letters to their families while they were in his dungeons, although there is no evidence that he sent these out. In fact, it seems he took some sort of perverse joy in letting the children believe that their families knew of their ordeal, when in reality he was taking the letters and reading them to his friends, which they all would get a laugh out of, after which he would destroy them. While these two girls were held captives, police started getting their first informants, who told them that Mark had contacted them and asked them to help him go out and procure young girls in a white van that he had stolen. Although it seems that police, knowing what they knew about this man, did absolutely nothing at the time. On August 22, 1995, 17-year-old Anne Marshall and 19-year-old F.G. Lembrix were kidnapped while on a camping trip in Ostend by Mark and his accomplice, Michael Levere. And apparently, the dungeons that he had created were already in use, although there were multiple dungeons, which leads me to believe that there were more than just the 2 8-year-old girls who were inside of them. So these two teenagers were kept drugged and chained to beds in one of the bedrooms at Mark's properties. At some point in September, Weinstein and another man by the name of Felipe Divers stole a van and hid it out in an aircraft hangar. The van was eventually found by the hangar's owner, and the police came and claimed it. Now, Mark and Weinstein suspected that Divers and his friend Pierre Rochow had betrayed them. So on the night of November 4th, they decided to kidnap the two men, and they drove them back to Weinstein's house, where they were drugged and subdued and tied up, basically, while they were interrogated. After which point, the two men left the house and went over to Rochow's to look for clues about the van. While they were there, they discovered Rochow's girlfriend, Benedict Shadat, who they took prisoner before returning to Weinstein's home, at which point it seems that they interrogated her as well before drugging and restraining her. Weinstein and Mark then left the home to go look for a fourth individual who they believed was involved in turning information over to the police. And while they were out of the house, Benedict was able to escape her restraints and contact the neighbors, who called the police. This is one of the first areas in the case where things get really murky. Apparently, it was only Weinstein that was wanted by the police at this point, and because of this, Mark decided that he needed to kill the man in order to prevent him from talking when he was eventually captured. So he kidnaps Weinstein on November 13th and brings him to the house in Marcinelle. And while he had Weinstein held captive in the house, he allowed the two teenagers, Lejeune and Russo, to roam freely throughout. I imagine that his wife was there and kept the girls from escaping. It appears that Mark committed some pretty brutal acts of torture on Weinstein before taking hose clamps and attaching them to his testicles in order to get information from him, specifically where Weinstein hid his money. After this, Mark forced the man to help him bury the two teenage girls alive. They did this by wrapping them in plastic and putting them into two graves inside of a garden on one of his properties. Afterwards, Mark did the same thing to Weinstein. Somewhere in here, a man named Claude contacted the police and told them that Mark had been driving around with him off and on since 1992, pointing out young girls to the man who Mark claimed would sell well and pull a hefty profit in this pedophile network that he was involved in. According to court records, there was some type of competition between local police and the Get Armies, who were really like military police, I guess. And it was this competition between the two groups that the court later decided was the reason that nothing was really done concerning Mark and the things that this informant said. At some point, again, the head of the dossier on Mark, a guy by the name of Remy Michaud, organized secret surveillance on Mark and his properties that was known under the codename of Operation Othello. And this operation was active for over 5 months. This is important because it is known that a number of children went missing during the period that he was under surveillance, yet police never noted or stated that they saw him with any young girls in his possession. However, we know that at least 4 children were in his possession at this period of time, being held captives in the various properties, and not only that, being shuttled around 2 different properties. So the idea that they didn't see anything seems absolutely ludicrous, especially because by this point Mark had become their prime suspect in the disappearance of the 2 8-year-old girls. On December 6, 1995, Claude was recognized by his old friend, Pierre Rachau, who contacted the police, who promptly arrested him. According to records, the police wanted to send a constable over to the various properties that Mark owned to do searches on them. However, this Remy character would not allow it, in fact blocked it, and stated that he would be the one to do the searches, as he knew Mark fairly well, as his group had been watching him for 5 months. And this is that period of time that I was talking about in the trailer, where Remy and this locksmith go to the house on 2 separate occasions, and they find hundreds of videotapes and torture devices and chains and all manner of awful things, pornographic material, child pornography, and they also found the dungeons. And while they were in the dungeons is when the locksmith is reported to have heard the screams and cries of children, and said that he was not going to leave until they tore the house apart and the victims were found. To which Remy is supposed to have said,
who's the police officer here, you or me? He later said that the reason he said this was because he believed that the screams of the children were coming from outside. However, when the screams were heard, the two men were in the dungeon below the house. So the idea that he heard children from outside the house screaming is absolute bullshit. While Mark was in jail, his wife, Michelle, was left to care for the 2 8-year-olds that were in the dungeon, and she was instructed to feed the children and give them water. She later stated that she was too scared to go down into the dungeons by herself, so instead she just threw food down there to the girls. However, it was never thrown close enough to them that they were able to reach it. And unfortunately, the two girls ended up starving to death inside of this dungeon. Interesting bit of information here, and I talked about all of the videotapes that were taken from the house. Apparently, this Remy character marked some of the videotapes as not being significant to the investigation. However, none of the videotapes were looked at, which means that somehow he magically knew which tapes were important and which tapes were not. The idea that they had, you know, they're looking for these missing children, and this guy's their prime suspect. They find hundreds of videotapes, videotaping equipment, and a dungeon inside this guy's house, and don't look at the videotapes is absolutely asinine. How this guy still has a job and was in fact promoted because of this case is beyond me. He should be locked in a dungeon for a very long time, if for no other reason than gross incompetence, but more likely than not because he facilitated the continuance of these crimes by not following through on the evidence that was before him. So after these two inspections of the house, all this information is taken, all this stuff is retrieved from the house, this Remy jerk-off turns around and just calls off Operation Othello and says that Mark has nothing to do with any of these crimes, and he's eventually released. After being released from jail, Mark goes back to the house where the 2 8-year-old girls' bodies are. And initially, he told police later after he was arrested yet again that they were alive when he arrived, but on death's door. When he was in court, he changed that to they were dead when he got there. In any event, he took these two young girls' bodies over to the house in Sars La Bouzière and buried them in the garden near where he had buried Weinstein's body. On May 28, 1996, Mark and Levier kidnapped a 12-year-old girl by the name of Sabine Dardenne, who was cycling to school. She was taken to the home in Marcinelle, where she was kept in the dungeon, almost starved to death, beaten, tortured, and drugged and raped. On August 9th, 1996, the two men went and found a 14-year-old by the name of Leticia Delhez as she was walking to a swimming hole. This time, however, the white van that they were driving was seen by a witness, and this witness was able to give the police a partial license plate. On August 13, 1996, because of this information that was given to police, Martin, his wife, and Levier were arrested. The police went and searched the home once again, although they claim they found nothing. 2 days after this, Mark and his accomplice, Levier, confessed to their crimes. and on this same day, he led police to the home where he had Sabian and Leticia held captive. And amazingly, these two young women were saved. On August 17th, he led police to his house in Sars-la-Bazière and showed them where the bodies of Lejeune, Russo, and Weinstein were buried. On September 3rd, the bodies of Marshall and Lambrix were exhumed from the house in Jumet. And this is where things in this case go completely off the fucking rails. Because the two girls who were held captive in the house and rescued told police that Martin and his buddy were not the only men who were involved in their rape and torture. They went on to provide the police with a list of men, many of them very high ranking in Belgian politics, law enforcement, and the criminal court system. You know what happened? Abso-fucking-lutely nothing. The court turned around and said that these two girls were mistaken and labeled one of them a liar. But there was more. It came out during the period after his arrest when they were getting ready for trial that Mark's own mother had contacted the police and told them what her son was up to. It further came out that Mark had approached a police officer who he was friends with and offered the man money if he could help him procure young girls. This in turn led to a very large commission that was set up to look into his activities. And in February of 1998, the commission came back and said he had no accomplices in the justice system or in high positions in the police department, as he, as well as the girls who had been rescued, continued to claim. More information came out, however, when it was learned by the public that the police had a fairly good idea of what it was that he was involved in and had actually traveled outside of the country to watch him while he raped young girls. That's not conjecture, that's in the police reports themselves, at least those that have been made available to the public. Something else that came out during this period of time is that Mark's wife, Michelle, was named by one of the victims as being the ringleader of what took place. The girl stated that Michelle would take these young girls out of the house at night to what she called sex parties, and that Michelle abused children in a very sadistic way. And when they went to these parties, Mark would show up and bring drugs, while the upper echelon members of these parties would basically rape the girls for hours on end. And it wasn't just the girls that Mark himself had kidnapped who were at these parties. It was numerous other young girls who had gone missing in the weeks, months, and years prior to these girls' disappearances. So basically what these victims were saying is that they were kidnapped, held captive, horrifically tortured, and then brought to parties where individuals who had a lot of money, power, and prestige were at, and that they, along with numerous other unknown girls, were then passed around these parties like party favors. And of course, the judge turned around and said, this is all bullshit. And while the judge was saying all of this, the gabardines were in damage control mode when asked by the group that had been set up to investigate the shortcomings in investigating Mark. Remy is on the record as stating that he never looked at any of the videotapes because a VCR was not available to him to look at the tapes. Just allow that one to sink in for a moment. It's 1996, 1997, and he can't get his hands on a VCR. And he works for the state's police department. Nothing about that sentence smacks of anything even approaching truth. It gets better, however, because right after the report was published about him, in April of 1998, while being transferred to the courthouse without handcuffs, Mark overpowered one of his guards, took the man's gun, and escaped. He was caught a few hours later. The Minister of Justice, the Minister of the Interior, and the police chief all resigned as a result of this. Things continued to get worse, however, with this case, as these investigators who were looking to build the case that they had against Mark were told to stop looking into things, with one investigator later stating in a documentary that we were coming close to some things, perhaps, and we were told that we did not need to look any further. In conjunction with this, parents of the deceased victims were denied access to seeing their daughter's remains, with the courts stating that it would not be good for them to see their children's bodies and that it might adversely affect their psychological states. This was such a massive clusterfuck that 29 police officers, prominent businessmen, and gabardines were arrested in connection with the suspected pedophile ring. And it was at this point that the people of Belgium decided that they had had enough and began going on strike throughout the country, as well as protesting what they saw as a blatant cover-up and corruption within their government and police forces. With all of this going on, the Belgian government told the media not to cover any of it. But that was not going to make this thing go away, however. In October of 1996, an estimated 300,000 Belgians marched through the streets of Brussels wearing white to signify purity and innocence. And this was after a judge, Jean-Marc Cornonet, was removed from the case. He was removed because he attended a fundraising dinner for victims' families, and another individual in the justice system decided that this had tainted his impartiality. Basically, the fallout from this was the people of Belgium demanded that the people responsible for all of these fuck-ups were removed, and many of them were. And the Belgian government really restructured quite a bit as a result of this, as did the various police departments. A lot of other suspicious things happened regarding this case, however. The man who had informed police in 1992 and a number of other occasions that Mark had driven him around and pointed out young girls to him that would, you know, fetch a high price on the black market, went missing on April 2nd of 1995 after he told a friend that he received important information about Mark. His foot was found in a river in April of 1995. 1996, although his body has never been recovered. Simon Pouchelet, who was a policeman that was investigating various aspects of Mark's case, was shot to death during a night shift on February 21st, 1996. March 7th of 1997, a prisoner by the name of Christian Conrads was found dead after escaping from his jail cell. This guy was supposed to be questioned about his involvement in Mark's ring. On April 25th, 1997, 2 days before he was set to testify to police, a man by Jose Stepe, who was a fairly well-to-do businessman, dropped dead, and the inquest into this man's death found that poisons were inside his asthma inhaler. On April 5th, 1998, a friend of Michelle Nahul, who was another, I can't find if she was a girlfriend or an associate of Mark's. This individual's name was Brigitte Genard, and this woman committed suicide on April 7th. A woman by the name of Anna Kachavoda, who contacted the police to let them know about the pornography ring that Mark was involved in, was found beaten and choked to death with her body dumped in a river. November 15th, 1998, a social worker named Gina Pardenes told friends that she had seen a tape in which a young girl who was known to one of Mark's accomplices was beaten and murdered. This woman died in a car crash. An ex-girlfriend of one of Mark's other accomplices, Sandra Clays, committed suicide on November 4th, 1999. In April of 2001, another acquaintance of Mark, Nadege Renard, died in a car crash after letting the police know he had a list of individuals who may have been involved in the pedophile ring. That's just a small handful of the people that were involved in this case who died in premature manners. A number of other individuals died in car crashes by unknown means and suicides. So it's really easy to see why yet the people of Belgium rose up against their government and against the justice system that was supposed to protect them. Mark's trial began March 1st, 2004, and according to him, he was a lower echelon procurer of young women in a massive pedophile ring, and he claimed that Michelle Nahal was the organizer of these abductions. Now, this Michelle is not the Michelle that Mark was married to. However, one witness did state that she was a ringleader at some of these parties that she had been brought to where she was raped and assaulted. In the end, over 450 people were called to testify at the trials, a number of them being individuals who claimed to have been victims of Mark and the pedophile network that he stated he was a part of. Although Mark, who testified, retracted much of what he said after his arrest and confession, he claimed to have raped and assaulted many of the girls and to have kidnapped and or held them in his homes. He said he never killed any of them. On June 22, 2004, Mark received a life sentence, while his wife, Michelle Martin, received 30 years, and their accomplice, Levier, got 25 years. Michelle Nahal was acquitted on the kidnapping and conspiracy charges, although he was convicted on drug-related offenses, for which he got 5 years. He died on October 23rd, 2019. 2,000 people protested in Brussels on August 19th, 2012, when Michelle Martin was paroled from prison. She served 16 years of her sentence. Now, as for Mark, he was given the pre-parole right to have a psychiatric assessment and something called the Black March took place because of this, as Mark is eligible for parole this year in 2021, although from what I could see, he has not yet been released and no judgment has been made as to whether or not he will be released. The almost three-quarters of the individuals in Belgium who share the same last name as Mark changed their names after it came to light what crimes he was suspected of. And while I don't know the exact number of individuals who applied to have their names changed, I do know that it is in the hundreds of thousands, which should tell you just how infamous and hated this man is. And I would imagine that were he to be released from prison, there will more likely than not be a major uprising in Belgium, and he himself may end up falling victim to the hands of street justice, which I can't say I would shed a tear over. My personal belief is that this man and everyone who is involved in his crimes should have been executed long ago for the things that he did, and those who helped to cover it up should have swiftly followed suit. So that is the shocking, disturbing, and confounding case of Mark Dutroux. Hope you enjoyed listening to this week's episode. If you want to find out more about Mark Dutroux, I came across his name in a book by the name of Pedogate Primer, The Politics of Pedophilia by reporter Philip Fairbanks. And while I don't agree with everything that this guy has said in the book, it's laid out in such a manner that he's not seeking to push conspiracy theories or anything along those lines. He's just laying out facts as to what's going on and what has happened in various cases, and oftentimes how it has been covered up by various organizations. He also shows how members of the LGBT community and people who fought for their civil rights have had their histories whitewashed. And I'm not talking about a whole bunch of people, so I'm not trying to say the entire, you know, movement is mired in these individuals. But there were a number of people who were involved in the movement from the 1960s up until, you know, as early as 2 or 3 years ago, who were openly pushing to have things like pedophilia, sex between adults and children, legalized as they saw it as only being natural and a good thing. One of these individuals, who I'm not going to name because he is an absolute scumbag, stated that any parent who did, of a queer child who did not want their children to have a relationship with a full-grown adult man should have their children taken away from them. This guy was a big proponent of gay rights, and he is one of those whose history has been whitewashed, particularly his involvement and support of NAMBLA, which is the North American Man-Boy Lovers Association, which is a group of absolutely disgusting scum fucks who should be rounded up and shot to a man. That is it for the DeathCast this week. Again, I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. The DeathCast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Until next week, stay morbid.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.